Bigfoot, Nessie, Chupacabra. Are these and other purported monsters the real deal? Or are they really not more than a fantasy of those who want to believe? We'll ask those questions on The Cryptid Report. Welcome to The Cryptid Report. I am Jim Harold, and so glad to be with you once again. And one of the things that fascinates me in the world of cryptozoology is the idea of the sea monster, the monster in the water. And for me, it's one of those things where if you think that there are strange creatures out there, as little as we know about the sea, it's probably very likely that's where they are living. In fact, new species are discovered all the time in the depths, things that we either thought were extinct or we never knew existed. So I think it's quite logical to think that there might actually be sea monsters out there. And we have someone who on the line who I think thinks the same way. I'm talking about J.H. Moncrief. She is an author, and her recent book, which is a fictional book, but not totally fiction in the sense that she has an interest in these things. And we'll talk about some of the lore and the possibility of these things being real. It's called Monsters in Our Wake. And it talks about the Neken, which is actually spelled N. And I think it's an O, but it's a special Norse type O, K-K-E-N, but it's pronounced. J.H. gave me a lesson before we started. It is the Neken. Now, J.H. Moncrief's work has been described as early Gillian Flynn with a little Ray Bradbury and Stephen King thrown in for good measure. Boy, that's a big compliment. That's great. She won Harlequin's Search for the Next Gillian Flynn in 2016. Her first published novella, The Bear Who Wouldn't Leave, was featured in Sam Haines' Childhood Fears collection and stayed on its horror bestseller list for over a year. When not writing, she loves exploring the world's most haunted places, advocating for animal rights, and summoning her inner ninja in classes. And we're so glad to have her with us. And she's going to tell you later on how you can get free ebooks and a spooky new story every week. J.H. Moncrief, welcome to the program today.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
So what got you interested in sea monsters?
I think since I was a little girl, even, I've always been fascinated by them. There was the series of books called The Time Life Mysteries of the Unexplained.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, they had volumes about mysterious creatures, and I've always loved that stuff. I used to read it even when it gave me nightmares. I just found it fascinating.
So talk to us now. You gave me a pronunciation lesson, the Neken. What is the Neken? Where did it come from, and how does it play in this story?
Well, I should say that the creature in my book isn't necessarily a Neken, but I named him that as a bit of an Easter egg. I'm Scandinavian, so almost all the names, actually I think all the given names of creatures in my book are the names of Scandinavian sea monsters, because I thought that would be kind of a neat thing to do. And so far, you're the only person that picked up on the fact that it's an actual creature, not just a weird name.
We try to do a little bit of homework on these shows.
Yeah, so I thought that would be a really fun thing to do. Like some people know, so obviously there's a character named Thor, so that's not really that subtle. But Neken and Drogon, and there's one I'm not even going to attempt to pronounce. They're all the name of sea monsters in Norse mythology, and Norse mythology is fascinating. They've got so many different creatures and legends, and aside from Thor and Odin, not too many people know about it. So it's a great untapped mine of ideas and stories.
Now, how do you go about taking something that has some basis, in fact, whether it's just mythology or if we were talking about the Loch Ness Monster or Bigfoot or whatever it may be, how do you take that? And I know that this case, it's not a prototypical Neken, as it were, but how do you take something like that and then figure out how to weave that into a fictional story? It would seem a little bit challenging to me. How do you do that?
Well, I think it helps that I've been a journalist for 20 years. So I have a really strong background writing nonfiction. So I think maybe that helped a little bit. It's easy for me to take pieces of real life or real situations, or in this case, real creatures, if they're real, but I'd like to think that there's something out there, and weave it into a fictional narrative that will seem real to people. So for instance, for Monsters in Our Wake, I did a ton of research and had sources for the oil industry side of it because it was set on a drill ship. So there's that fact, and I think that makes it maybe a little bit easier for readers to accept the things that are a bit more mystical or a bit more supernatural, for lack of a better word, because there's so much fact in there that maybe it makes it a little easier or a little more realistic, if that makes sense.
Many of us will never see the sea even, let alone sail on it or be on an oil rig or whatever it might be. Why are we fascinated by cryptid creatures and monsters and sea monsters specifically? Why do you think that is?
I think because I honestly believe there's something in human nature that we still need to believe in magic. I think, you know, when we're growing up and we're kids, a lot of us are taught to believe in Santa Claus or the Tooth Fairy or Jack Frost. And, you know, we grow up believing that there might be these beings we can't see that do these wonderful things. And when you become an adult, it's kind of, you know, the world is sort of empty without any of that magic, without believing in something you can't see. So I think people are still, we still want to believe that there's something beyond the tangible world. We still want to believe that there's something magical out there. And I think that's a big part of it with sea monsters. I don't think many people would want to actually experience one, like be out on a little rickety boat and then have this huge thing come out of the water. But I think there's that need to believe in something beyond ourselves. I think that drives a lot of it.
And that's interesting. The need to believe in magic. That's an interesting way of putting it. I've not heard that before. I do like it though, because I think that's true. You know, you grow up and you're told about Santa Claus and you're told about the Tooth Fairy, and then all of a sudden someone comes along, and if there ain't small children there, you may want to get them out of the room. But anybody listening, people say, well, maybe we exaggerated just a tad, and you kind of go, oh. And to think that, yeah, maybe there is magic that exists in the universe, I think that is a big part of it. What do you think makes, you know, for fiction, I think it's very important to have a monster or a villain that's very frightening. What are the, you know, and I think about that great movie Alien with Sigourney Weaver, and that alien, I mean, that was just something visceral in seeing that was just very frightening. So you don't have the screen to give that effect, but how do you make a creature terrifying on the pages of paper? What goes into that?
Well, it's interesting that you asked me that, because in Monsters in Our Wake, the actual monster is how people react when they don't understand something. So my original idea was to have the book from the creature's point of view and have the people be the monsters. And it turned out to be a little more complicated in that both sides have their flaws and both sides have their good points, so it wasn't as strictly good evil as I first expected it to be when I started writing. But my definite idea was that this creature that everybody would be like, oh, this is the monster, is actually the sane, logical one, and it's the human beings who are behaving like monsters. But as far as making it terrifying, I think anything that's unpredictable and bigger than us, and I mean, the setting is so scary. I mean, these people are stranded out in the middle of the South Pacific. Their equipment isn't working. There's no one around them. So they're in a desperate situation, and there's this huge creature that's capable of destroying their entire ship. So I think that lends an element of terror to it, but also just how the people are behaving to each other kind of becomes Lord of the Flies on a boat. So I think that was probably the scariest part of the book, is just how people react in crisis situations.
Yeah, and sometimes the humans are scarier than the monsters. You talked before we started, and it's interesting because they said, well, is this just something you write because you love to write fiction, or do you still have a belief that maybe monsters out there may exist on some level? And I thought your answer was really interesting. Maybe you could share that with the folks out there now.
Well, I honestly believe that what we call monsters are just creatures that either were extinct or that we believe to be extinct but aren't actually extinct, or things that we haven't discovered yet. If you Google sea monsters, a lot of the things that you'll find are actually things that do exist that are just so bizarre and so strange. But they're coming from a level of the ocean that it's very, very hard for human beings to reach. And there's still areas where I believe there's volcanoes under the sea and thermal vents and that, where it's almost impossible to research the creatures that are coming from that area. So that's what I believe, is that the things that we necessarily call monsters aren't. And I just think, too, with when you look at human history, there's a sameness to the reports over and over and over again. For almost every culture in the world, they have their quote-unquote sea monster. They have their dragon. And you have to wonder why. Like, why does everybody have the same stories? There wasn't the same global connection back then. So why does everyone have the same lore if there was absolutely no truth behind it? So I think there is something there, and it wouldn't surprise me at all if someday we find evidence, we find fossils that backs that up.
I love that, because that's exactly the way that I think about it, is the idea that you have all these commonalities and you have all these great stories. And the thing that I love about the old reports, and I've said this on the programs before, is this idea that, you have somebody in 1880 giving an account of a sea monster. Now, today, if somebody gives an account of some kind of cryptid, or of a UFO, or of a ghost, or of all these different things, I sometimes put my skeptical cap on, because I'm like, oh, are they, they saw something in the movies, they saw something on television, they read something, maybe they're tainted, maybe they're kind of exaggerating, maybe not even intentionally. But on the other hand, when you read these accounts from the 1800s or even before of sea monsters, boy, those seem credible to me, because maybe they could have read some kind of short story or novella or something about a sea monster, or maybe something in a newspaper in the 1800s. But that's about it. It wasn't like this stuff was all over the place like it is today. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, for sure. And typically, I mean, this is, of course, a huge generalization, but I don't think your typical sailor back in those days was an overly imaginative type.
Or maybe even not even literate.
Exactly. So, I mean, people were seeing stuff out there. What was it? I mean, a lot of people dismiss it as, oh, it was a giant squid. And it very well might be, but why isn't that, why isn't that what we consider a monster? Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. About people looking for this, I mean, one of the people in your book, who is, I believe, a protagonist, is a marine geologist. Are there people out there today, as best you know, who are kind of researching sea monsters? Maybe they don't call it sea monsters, but unknown species. What are you aware of that's being done out there today to find real life sea monsters, or just, if we are more comfortable, creatures we don't know about?
I do believe there's quite a few people actually that are doing this sort of research. I was lucky in that I also got to spend 10 years working for a museum, and I got to know, not that there were people searching for sea monsters there, but I definitely know a lot of curators and scientists who were doing geology and paleontology and anthropology, doing all this different work. So I definitely know how it works, and I know that there's people that have scanned Loch Ness with radars and have found things that they can't understand and can't explain. But unfortunately, and this is one of the things that drives me crazy about this area of science, is that the people that perpetuate the hoaxes set us back so far. Because if there wasn't people doing the hoax thing, things that were found would be taken more seriously. But now so much work has to be done just to make sure that the photograph wasn't faked or the video wasn't faked, that I think so much energy is spent now trying to disprove things that it takes the energy away from trying to prove anything or trying to find anything. So that's really disheartening for me, like to know that original photo from the 1930s that's so famous of the Loch Ness Monster was faked now. It's just like, really? Like, why? why'd you have to do that? Like, come on. I just really wish that, you know, we could concentrate on only presenting what is actually real evidence than trying to come up with an elaborate balloon or something that might look like something and taking a photo of it. Like, it's really disappointing to me.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. I think you're absolutely spot on. I actually get angry about the hoaxers, whether particularly if you look at something like Bigfoot. Now it's just become a big joke. And it's very sad because, you know, I think people of goodwill believe that they've seen something. Now, whether it was Bigfoot or it wasn't Bigfoot, you know, who knows? But I don't think everyone who has sightings of these kind of creatures, whether they're on land or on sea, is crazy or a hoaxer or a liar. They may be mistaken. I think that's possible. But it is unfortunate. It's one of those things where a bad apple kind of spoils the whole bunch. Now, the supernatural in general seems to be an interest to you. You also write on ghosts, don't you?
Yes, I do, quite a bit. And that I have had experiences with. So while I haven't seen a sea monster, I have definitely experienced the paranormal in that form. So I can't walk around saying, oh, no, they don't exist, or maybe they do. That one I can't confirm. I can't confirm sea monsters, although I would love to.
And what has the reaction to the book been so far?
It's been really good. I was really nervous, actually, when Severed said they wanted to publish it, because it's not your typical sea creature story where it's like, oh, the creatures are bad and they're murderous and there's some macho guys who kill everything. It's not that type of story at all. And I was really concerned about how people would take the creature having a point of view, but they've been actually really good about it. And in all my reviews, pretty much 2 of 1, everybody's mentioned that that was a part that they really liked, was hearing from the creature itself. So I was like, whew, okay, good. Because I wasn't sure people who like this genre would accept that.
Well, in your profile that I was reading at the beginning of the show, you said that you're an advocate for animal rights. Seems like some of those themes would come through in here, don't they?
Very strongly. It's personally, this book started out, my first gem of an idea started out as a diatribe against the oil industry, because I was so upset about environmental destruction and fracking and overseas drilling and stuff like that. And so it started out that way. But as soon as I gave the people working on the ship a voice, I was reminded of, well, the dilemmas that oil workers go through, where everybody has to make a living, everybody's got to eat. Sometimes this is the only job you can get. It pays really well. So I had more of a sympathy and an understanding while I was writing, but it started out as a rant against what's being done to the natural world because of the oil industry. And I do think we need to find a better way, but I acknowledge that the place we're at now, sometimes things are done that destroy the environment that really nobody has an alternative for, unfortunately.
It really is one of those things where I kind of see myself as kind of in the middle, because on one hand, for example, in the, and this is a small example, but it's really kind of disheartening. I live in a suburb, and we had a goodly amount of woods for a long time, and then various things have been developed and done away with a lot of the woods, and now we have a quote deer problem. So our wise leaders have decided to control the deer population, which I know that there are reasons for having to do that, but I would think that there should be some kind of humane way of doing that. And they've done a bolt through the head as the way of killing these deer. And to me, it just seems incredibly insensitive. And it's like, couldn't you find a better way? Isn't there one other way than shooting a bolt through a deer's head? Who, by the way, was minding his or her own business until we decided to knock down all the woods and build a shopping mall. So, on the other hand, I know that, you know, as you said, people have to make a living. There's development. There's things that are built for good reasons. So it is striking that balance. And I think it's a very challenging thing to do, and something we really have to focus on.
For sure. Like stuff like that, the deer, that horrifies me. And
yeah, it's horrible.
A lot
it's
of,
horrible.
Yeah, and a lot of the problem is, well, you know, that was probably a wolf kill that they did. So now the deer have no natural predators. So we killed the natural predators off because, oh no, a cow died or a pig died. Not that that's not a bad thing. It is. But I mean, there's such a huge overreaction if anyone is ever threatened by a bear or a wolf, or if any livestock dies, there's such a huge overreaction. Oh, we got to kill all the wolves now. And then the things that would normally control deer are gone. So now we got to control the deer. And it's just, where does it end? And then eventually they'll start bringing the wolves back. And it's a cycle all over again. The first time a wolf kills something, it's like, oh, now we got to kill the wolves. Like, it just, I sometimes wish people would just learn to live in harmony with nature rather than trying to control it all the time. We can't control everything.
It's absolutely true. And one of the reasons was because it would eat people's plants. And it's like, well, get some fencing or do, you know, I mean, a leaf here or a leaf there. I don't think it's the end of the world. It just seemed kind of extreme to me. Now, in terms of sea monsters, do you think that we'll ever capture a sea monster or actually get definitive proof of a sea monster or those kind of things? I know that we have small species that all the time are being discovered at the depths of the ocean as we can go deeper and deeper and have better and better imaging. Do you have hope that maybe we'll find a big one sometime?
This is going to sound weird considering what your podcast is about, but I really hope we don't, because
okay.
I think that if we did, the first reaction would be to kill it. I think that's what we would do. I think people would kill it and they bring it up in a net to study it and that. And, you know, if there is something out there, I just hope it lives in peace. I would love to see something more definitive, like the studies they've done in Loch Ness, where something did come up on radar that was alive, that was extremely large, but they couldn't figure out what it was. There was no explanation for it. I would love to see more sophisticated imaging and more reports come out of that research. But as far as capturing an actual creature, I really hope they don't, because that pretty much signs its death warrant, I think.
No, I think that makes a lot of sense. Did anything surprise you in your research for this book, or anything you learned about sea monsters and the idea of sea monsters that you wish more people knew?
That's a great question. I think really what I wish more people knew is that there's so much we don't know, that there's new species being discovered all the time, that it's not, I think a lot of people, especially those who don't work in the scientific field, have this impression that we've discovered all there is to discover, but that's not true. There's areas of jungle that we haven't explored. There's definitely areas of the ocean, like we discussed, that haven't been explored. So we haven't hit the limit to discovery and finding all the creatures that might be out there. So as far as wanting people to know something about them, that would be it. Otherwise, the history and the lore of the Neckin is really interesting. I mean, it was a shape-shifting creature that appears sometimes as a beautiful man to lure women into the water. It appears as a white horse to lure children, and the children will ride on its back, and then it takes them into the water and drowns them. So it's quite a nasty but very interesting creature that I don't think probably a lot of people know about. So if people are interested in interesting mythological creatures, Scandinavia has tons that, you know, if you're outside of Scandinavia, people really don't know about them.
Yeah, that's interesting. The thing is that I don't understand how anybody can feel that we've got it all figured out. The world is so large. The universe is so large. To figure, whether we're talking about sea monsters or ghosts or UFOs, my default is that we really don't understand much of anything. I always go, and I mentioned this so many times in the show, so people may get tired of it. But Plato's allegory of the cave, the whole idea that we're kind of chained to this wall and we're seeing these shadows and we're trying to interpret them, but we really have no idea what they are. And my favorite example, and I've used it many times on the shows, is DNA. Now, DNA existed in 1700. The scientists of the time, you know, were doing great work for the technology and the tools and the education that they had, but they had no idea about DNA. And yet it was discovered in the 20th century and the genome has been mapped. And now we can send in a little bit of saliva and find out where we come from. And it's also, you know, incredibly useful in law enforcement and maybe freeing some people who were innocent and maybe convicting some people who weren't innocent. And it's just such a great thing. But the thing was, is that it existed that whole time. I'm sure that somewhere along the line, somebody brought up the idea of DNA and some mainstream scientist said, oh, that's just crazy. You know? And so to me, I think I love technology. Look, we couldn't do what we're doing now. I couldn't do my job with the tremendous technology of the internet that allows us to do things like podcast. I am a big fan of science, but I'm not a big fan of saying, hey, we got it all figured out, because the truth is, I just think we got a little teeny tiny part of it figured out, and there's so much more.
That was the great part about working at a museum for me, is even while I was there, the paleontologist, geologist that I worked with discovered a fossil that set the fossil record back, I believe it was 400 million years. So just what this one guy in Canada discovered told us that something that we thought existed here actually existed 400 million years before we thought it did. So every single day, scientists are changing what we know. They're finding out things that change what we always believe to be true. So there's not a lot of people wandering around who cares when jellyfish first arrived on the planet. But even that, you know, we're finding out that we were wrong about those things and those dates and what happened. So I mean, if something as small as a jellyfish, if we could be wrong about that, why can't we be wrong about bigger things?
Exactly.
I was recently in Egypt, and I went in some tombs, of course, like you do when you're in Cairo. And when I was in Luxor, I went into the Valley of the Kings, and there were these tombs. And when you've been in a few in Egypt, you start seeing the same things. You start seeing the same gods. I mean, you got Anubis, you got Ra, like you see the same things over and over. This particular tomb on the ceiling had a very, very clear picture of humanoid creatures with helmets that had antenna on them. Now, this is going back thousands and thousands of years. Why in the heck would they have drawn something like this? So I pointed this out to my group, and we're all talking, oh my God, it's aliens. You know?
Right.
And when we emerged from the tomb, I went to our Egyptologist and I said, you know, what's with the aliens? And he goes, oh, no, no, no. Those weren't aliens. No aliens. Those were demons. So I'm like, oh, that's so much better, honey. oh, demons. Okay. Yeah, that's a rational explanation. But you got to wonder, don't you? Like, what on earth would have made them draw something like that?
Exactly.
I'm not
right.
saying that I definitively believe there were space people wandering around back then, but it's really interesting to see stuff like that you would consider more, you know, communion era things that were done thousands and thousands of years ago. Like, what's going on? You know, it was really interesting.
I think it's interesting that reasonable people, and this is the thing that gets me, and we've kind of gotten off of cryptids, but kind of to more philosophical discussion. But I think there's this feeling out there, and I extend this to our listeners. I'm not saying they feel this way, but I think they're probably painted it with this brush if they let it be known they're interested in these topics. There's an assumption if somebody is interested in the paranormal or UFOs, or cryptozoology, or any of these topics, that were kooks. And that is not necessarily the case at all. In fact, some very, very intelligent people that I've met and had discourse with, and people with advanced degrees and professionally accomplished, and they're fascinated by these topics. But for some reason, you know, we're the strange ones because we're interested in that. And that's kind of, you know, I feel like picking up my banner and kind of saying, hey, we're not the dumb ones. We're not the crazy ones. We're not the ones with a closed mind. We're inquisitive and we think that there may be more, you know, and of course there are extremes in every situation. You know, I had an author on one time who swore that he was in a cold climate and he decided to teleport to the Bahamas. Now, I didn't necessarily buy that, but that's an outlier. That's an extreme. I think that people like us should be applauded because we are willing to have an open mind and say, hey, I don't understand it all. And there might be some really strange stuff out there. I think that should be a sign of intelligence and competence, not the opposite.
Well, look how they treated people who said that, you know, the earth wasn't the be all end all, that the sun didn't revolve around it. Look how they were treated hundreds of years ago, right?
Exactly. But
as far as that goes, I feel an immediate sympathy for anyone who seems sincere, who experiences, sees something in the sky or sees Bigfoot or thinks they've seen the Loch Ness Monster. I feel an immediate sympathy for them, because if they are telling the truth, no one's going to believe them, and they're going to get accused of doing it for publicity, and they're going to get accused of doing it for money. And I don't know, is there some organization that I'm not aware of that pays thousands of dollars for these reports? Because I'm not aware of anybody making a huge amount of money from, you know, having to flee their house because there's a poltergeist in it, or saying that they've seen the Loch Ness Monster. I mean, they may maybe get 15 minutes of fame, but who even remembers their name a month later? So I can't see going through the ridicule and the embarrassment of coming clean about these things just to get some fame, unless you're really disturbed. And I mean, I have, like you mentioned, I have seen people like that, but there's people out there that are very sincere and seem to me to be very intelligent, professional people who've seen things that we would call monsters, or seen things that, you know, we can't explain or would be, you know, thrown under the paranormal heading. And I can't believe that they're all lying, that they're all making this up just to get money or fame, because really the money and fame that results from these things is very minimal at best, I would think.
I agree totally. We have our show Campfire. And that is the basis of the show. People call in and tell their stories, and there's really no gain in it for them. There's certainly not any fame. I mean, among podcasts, it's popular. I mean, I won't downgrade the show, but compared to, you know, being on the Tonight Show or the CBS Evening News, you know, the audience is a lot less than that. And the thing is that they just give their first name. We intentionally keep it very kind of anonymous, so they feel comfortable telling their story. So there's no fame element into it. And I've had some of the greatest stories and some of the most sincere stories I've ever heard on that show. And that's even impacted my belief in these things and made it stronger. So the thing is, I am fully with you on board with this idea that everybody who tells these things, and I would say even probably the majority, are not in it for money or fame or crazy or whatever the case may be, but they're just sincere people. Who are just sharing what they have experienced. Now, we were talking a little bit offline, and you had a vision of what kind of monster this was in your book, Monsters in Our Wake, and how that might map to something that was considered to be real, and how that might map to another famous water monster. Tell me about that, because I thought that was fascinating.
Well, when I first was envisioning Neckin and his family, I thought of them as plesiosaurs, which... a big water resident, water dinosaur back in the day. And I just thought that, you know, a lot of people think that's what Nessie could be. That's how she's been described. And why not? Like, why couldn't there still be plesiosaurs? We've certainly had moments where people have thought that a certain animal was extinct and then found it decades later, found evidence that it wasn't actually extinct. So there could still be plesiosaurs living. So when I was writing the book, that's what I had in my mind.
Well, J.H., it's been a lot of fun speaking with you. If people are into cryptids and they want to find out more about Monsters in Our Wake or your other books that have supernatural and paranormal themes, where would you suggest they go?
Probably my website is the best place to start, because all of my information is on there, so they can find me on social media that way. So it's just jhmoncrief.com. Spelling my last name may be a little challenging, but if they get it close enough, they'll be able to find me in Google.
Well, it's been a lot of fun. The author is J.H. Moncrief. The book is Monsters in Our Wake. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun.
And thank you for tuning in to the Cryptid Report. We talked about cryptids and a lot of other things too. I hope you enjoyed it. I know I did. And we'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.